Part 5. To the Precipice. Chapter 42. Crossroad. William parted from the hunters at a nameless crossroads somewhere in New Jersey. It wasn't politic for him to go further. Their inquiries regarding the position of the Continental Army were being greeted with increasing hostility, indicating that they were getting close. Neither rebel sympathisers nor loyalists who feared reprisal from an army on their doorstep wished to say anything to mysterious travellers who might be spies, or worse. The Quakers would have an easier time of it without him. They were so plainly what they were, and Denzel's intent to enlist as a surgeon both so simple and so admirable that, if they were alone, people would help them, he thought. Or at least receive their inquiries more kindly. With William, though. Saying that he was a friend of the hunters had been sufficient earlier in the journey. Folk were curious about the little group, but not suspicious. As they drew farther into New Jersey, though, the agitation of the countryside increased markedly. Farms had been raided by foraging parties, both by Hessians from Howe's army trying to lure Washington into open battle from his lurking place in the Watchung Mountains, and from the Continental Army, desperate for supplies. Farmhouses that would normally have welcomed strangers for the news they bore now repelled them with muskets and harsh words. Food was growing harder to find. Rachel's presence sometimes helped them get close enough to offer money, and William's small store of gold and silver was certainly helpful. Denzel had put most of the money from the sale of their house with a bank in Philadelphia to secure Rachel's future safety, and the paper money issued by the Congress was almost universally rejected. There was no means by which William could masquerade as a Quaker, though. Beyond his inability to master plain speech, his size and bearing made people nervous, the more so as he, with the memories of Captain Nathan Hale vivid in his mind, wouldn't say that he meant to enlist in the Continental Army, nor ask any questions that might later be presented as evidence of spying. His silence, perceived as menacing, also made people nervous. He hadn't spoken to the hunters regarding their parting, and both Denzel and Rachel had been careful not to ask about his own plans. Everyone knew the time had come, though. He could feel it in the air when he woke that morning. When Rachel handed him a chunk of bread for breakfast, her hand brushed his, and he nearly seized her fingers. She felt the strength of his stifled impulse and looked up, startled, directly into his eyes. More green than brown today, and he would have sent discretion to the devil and kissed her. He thought she wouldn't have objected, had her brother not just then emerged from the bushes, buttoning his flies. He chose the place, all of a sudden. Naught to be gained by delay, and maybe better to do it without thinking too much. He pulled his horse to a stop in the middle of the crossroad, startling Denzel, whose mare bridled and danced at the jerk on her reins. "I will leave you here," William said abruptly, and more harshly than he had intended. "My way lies north." He nodded in that direction, and thank God the sun was up so he could tell which way north was. "While I think that if you continue to the east, you will encounter some representatives of Mr. Washington's army. If..." He hesitated, but they should be warned. From what the farmers said, it was plain that Howe had sent troops into the area. "If you meet with British troops or Hessian mercenaries, do you speak German by chance?" Denzel shook his head, eyes wide behind his spectacles. "Only a little French." "That's good. Most Hessian officers have good French. If you meet with Hessians who don't, and they offer to molest you, say to them, 'I demand to see your officer. I know his friend.' Say the same thing if you meet with British troops." A faint smile crossed Denzel's face. "I thank thee," he said. "But if they do take us to an officer, and he demands to know the name of this theoretical friend?" William smiled back. "It won't really matter. Once you're in front of an officer, you'll be safe. But as for a name, Harold Grey, Duke of Pardlow, Colonel of the 46th Foot. Uncle Hal didn't know everyone, as his own father did, but anyone in the military world would know him. Or of him, at least. He could see Denzel's lips move silently, committing this to memory. And who is friend Harold to thee, William? Rachel had been regarding him narrowly between the sagging brim of her hat, and now pushed this back on her head to view him more directly. He hesitated again, but after all, what did it matter now? He would never see the hunters again, and while he knew that Quakers would not be impressed by worldly shows of rank and family, he still sat straighter in his saddle. Some kin to me, he said casually, and digging in his pocket, brought out the small purse the Scotsman Murray had given him. Here, you will need this.
We will do well enough, Denzel said, waving it away.
So will I, William said, and tossed the purse toward Rachel, who put up her hands in reflex and caught it, looking as much surprised by the fact that she had done so as by his own action. He smiled at her too, his heart full.
Fare thee well,
he said gruffly, then wheeled his horse and set off at a brisk trot, not looking back.
Thee knows he is a British soldier, Denny Hunter said quietly to his sister, watching William ride away. Likely a deserter.
And if he is?
Violence follows such a man. Thee knows it. To remain long with such a man is a danger, not only to the body, but to the soul as well.
Rachel sat her mule in silence for a moment, watching the empty road. Insects buzzed loud in the trees. I think thee may be a hypocrite, Denzel Hunter, she said evenly, and pulled her mule's head around. He saved my life, and thine. Would thee prefer him to have held his hand and see me dead and butchered in that dreadful place? She shuddered slightly in spite of the heat of the day.
I would not, her brother said soberly, and I thank God that he was there to save thee. I am sinner enough to prefer thy life to the welfare of that young man's soul, but not hypocrite enough to deny it. No.
She snorted, and taking off her hat, waved away a gathering cloud of flies. I am honoured. But as for thy talk of violent men and the danger of being in the vicinity of such men, is thee not taking me to join an army? He laughed ruefully.
I am. Perhaps thee is right, and I am a hypocrite.
But, Rachel... He leaned out and caught her mule's bridle, keeping her from turning away.
Thee knows I would have no harm before thee, either of body or soul. Say the word, and I will find thee a place with friends, where you may stay in safety. I am sure that the Lord has spoken to me, and I must follow my conscience. But there is no need for thee to follow it too.
She gave him a long, level look. And how does thee know that the Lord has not spoken to me as well? His eyes twinkled behind his spectacles.
I am happy for thee. What did he say?
He said, keep thy fat-headed brother from committing suicide, for I will require his blood at thy hand, she snapped, slapping his hand away from the bridle. If we are going to join the army, Denny, let us go and find it.
She kicked the mule viciously in the ribs, its ears sprang straight up, and with a startled whoop from its rider, it shot down the road as though fired from a cannon. William rode for some way, back particularly straight, showing excellent form in his horsemanship. After the road curved out of sight of the crossroad, he slowed and relaxed a bit. He was sorry to leave the hunters, but already beginning to turn his thoughts ahead.
Burgoyne.
He'd met General Burgoyne once, at a play. A play written by the general, no less. He didn't recall anything about the play itself, as he'd been engaged in a flirtation of the eyes with a girl in the next box. But afterwards, he'd gone down with his father to congratulate the successful playwright, who was flushed and handsome with triumph and champagne. Gentleman Johnny, they called him in London. A light in London society's firmament, in spite of the fact that he and his wife had some years before been obliged to flee to France to escape arrest for debt. No one held debt against the man, though. It was too common. William was more puzzled by the fact that his Uncle Hal seemed to like John Burgoyne. Uncle Hal had no time for plays, nor for the people who wrote them, though, come to think, he had the complete works of Aphra Behn on his shelves, and William's father had once told him in deepest secrecy that his brother Hal had conceived a passionate attachment for Mrs. Behn following the death of his first wife and before his marriage to Aunt Minnie. Mrs. Behn was dead, you see, his father had explained. Safe. William had nodded, wishing to seem worldly and understanding, though in fact he had no real notion what his father meant by this. Safe? How safe? He shook his head. He didn't expect ever to understand Uncle Hal, and chances were that was best for both of them. His grandmother, Benedicta, was probably the only person who did. Thought of his uncle, though, led him to think of his cousin Henry, and his mouth tightened a little. Word would have reached Adam, of course, but likely he could do nothing for his brother. Neither could William, whose duty called him north. Between his father and Uncle Hal, though, surely. The horse threw up his head, snorting a little, and William looked ahead to see a man standing by the road, one arm raised to hail him. He rode slowly, a sharp eye on the wood, lest the man have Confederates hidden to waylay unwary travellers. The verge was open here, though, with a thick but spindly growth of saplings behind it. No one could hide in there. "Good day to you, sir," he said, reining up a safe distance from the old man. For old he was, his face was seamed like a tin mine slag heap. He leaned on a tall staff, and his hair was pure white, tied back in a plait. "Well met," the old gentleman said. Gentleman, for he stood proud, and his clothes were decent, and now William came to look, there was a good horse, too, hobbled and cropping grass some distance away. William relaxed a little. "Where do you fare, sir?" he asked politely. The old man shrugged a little, easy.
"That may depend upon what you can tell me, young man."
The old man was a Scot, though his English was good.
"I am in search of a man called Ian Murray, whom I think you know."
William was disconcerted by this. How did the old man know that? But he knew Murray. Perhaps Murray had mentioned William to him. He replied cautiously,
"I know him, but I'm afraid I have no idea where he is." "No?"
The old man looked keenly at him.
"So he thinks I might lie to him," William thought. "Suspicious old sod." "No," he repeated firmly. "I met him in the Great Dismal some weeks ago in company with some Mohawk. But I do not know where he might have gone since then." "Mohawk," the old man repeated thoughtfully.
And William saw the sunken eyes fasten on his chest, where the great bear claw rested outside his shirt.
"Did you get that wee bawbee from the Mohawk, then?"
"No," William replied stiffly, not knowing what a bawbee was, but thinking that it sounded in some way disparaging.
"Mr. Murray brought it to me from a friend." "A friend?"
The old man was frankly studying his face in a way that made William uncomfortable and therefore angry.
"What is your name, young man?"
"None of your business, sir," William said, as courteously as possible, and gathered his reins.
"Good day to you."
The old man's face tightened, as did his hand on the staff, and William turned sharply, lest the old bugger mean to try to strike him with it. He didn't, but William noticed, with a small sense of shock, that two fingers of the hand that grasped the staff were missing. He thought for a moment that the old man might mount and come after him, but when he glanced back, the man was still standing by the road, looking after him. It made no real difference, but, moved by some obscure notion of avoiding notice, William put the bear's claw inside his shirt, where it hung safely concealed next to his rosary. Chapter 43. Countdown. June the 18th, 1777. Fort Ticonderoga. Dear Bree and Roger, 23 days and counting. I hope we'll be able to leave on schedule. Your cousin Ian left the fort a month ago, saying that he had a wee bit of business to take care of, but would be back by the time Jamie's militia enlistment was up. Ian himself declined to enlist, being instead a volunteer forager, so he's not technically AWOL. Not that the fort's commander is really in a position to do anything about deserters, save hang them if they're silly enough to come back, and none of them do. I'm not sure what Ian's doing, but I have some hope that it may be good for him. Speaking of the fort's commander, we have a new one. Great excitement. Colonel Wayne left a few weeks ago, doubtless sweating with relief as much as with the humidity. But we have come up in the world. The new commander is a Major General, no less. One Arthur St. Clair, a genial and very handsome Scot, whose attractiveness is considerably enhanced by the pink sash he affects on formal occasions. The nice thing about belonging to an ad hoc army is that one apparently gets to design one's own uniform. None of this stuffy old British convention about regimentals. General St. Clair comes with outriders. No fewer than 3 lesser generals, one of them French. Your father says General Fermois is rather fishy, militarily speaking, and about 3,000 new recruits. This has substantially heartened everyone, though placing an ungodly strain on the latrine facilities. The lines are 15 deep in the mornings at the pits, and there is a severe shortage of thunder mugs, and St. Clair made a nice speech assuring us that the fort cannot possibly be taken now. Your father, who was standing next to the general at the time, said something under his breath in Gaelic at this point, but not very far under. And while I understand the general was born in Thurso, he conveniently affected not to understand. The bridge building between the fort and Mount Independence continues apace, and Mount Defiance continues to sit there across the water. An inoffensive little hill to look at, but a good bit higher than the fort. Jamie had Mr. Marsden row across with a target, a 4-foot square of wood painted white, and set it up near the top of the hill where it was plainly visible from the fort's batteries. He invited General Fermois, he does not get a pink sash, despite being French, to come and try his hand at shooting with one of the new rifles. Jamie, having thoughtfully abstracted several of these from the cargo of the Teal before patriotically donating the rest to the American cause. They blasted the target to bits, an act whose significance was not lost on General St. Clair, who came along to watch. I think General St. Clair will be almost as pleased as I will be when your father's enlistment is up. The new influx has made things busier, of course. Most of the new recruits are reasonably healthy, for a wonder, but there are the usual minor accidents, cases of venereal disease, and summer ague. Enough that Major Thatcher, he's the chief medical officer, has taken to turning a blind eye when I surreptitiously bind up a wound, though he draws the line at allowing me access to sharp instruments. Fortunately, I have a small knife with which to lance boils. I'm also growing very short of useful herbs since Ian's defection. He used to bring me things from his foraging expeditions, but it really isn't safe to venture out of the fort save in large bodies. 2 men who went out hunting a few days ago were found murdered and scalped. While my medical kit thus remains a little sparse, I have, for some compensation, acquired a ghoul. This is a Mrs. Raven from New Hampshire, whose husband is a militia officer. She's relatively young, in her 30s, but has never had children, and thus has a lot of emotional energy to expend. She battens on the sick and dying, though I'm sure she considers herself to be sympathetic in the extreme. She revels in ghastly detail, which, while mildly repulsive in itself, does make her a competent aide, since she can be counted on not to faint while I set a compound fracture or amputate quickly before Major Thatcher or his henchman, Lieutenant Stactoe, notices a gangrenous digit for fear of missing something. Granted, she does wail and carry on a bit and is much given to clutching her rather flat chest and allowing her eyes to bulge while describing these adventures to other people afterward. She nearly prostrated herself from hyperventilation when they brought in the men who were scalped. But one takes what one can get in the way of help. At the other end of the scale, in terms of medical competence, though, the new influx of recruits has brought with it a young Quaker doctor named Denzel Hunter and his sister Rachel. I haven't yet spoken to him personally, but from what I see, Dr. Hunter really is a doctor, and seems even to have some vague notion of germ theory, owing to his having trained with John Hunter, one of the great men of medicine. On the chance that Roger will be reading this, I will refrain from telling you the manner in which John Hunter discovered how gonorrhea is transmitted. Well, no, actually, I won't. He stabbed himself in the penis with a lancet covered in pus from an infected victim and was deeply gratified with the results, according to Denny Hunter, who recounted this interesting incident to your father while bandaging his thumb, which had got squashed between two rolling logs. Don't worry, it isn't broken, just badly bruised. I'd love to see how Mrs. Raven would take this story, but I suppose propriety would prevent young Dr. Hunter telling her. You are, of course, minding the children's vaccination schedule. With all my love, Mama. Brianna had closed the book, but her hand kept returning involuntarily to the cover, as though she wished to open it again, in case it might say something different. What's 23 days past June 18th? She should be able to reckon that. She could do things like that in her head. But nervousness had deprived her of the ability to compute.
30 days half September, Roger chanted quickly under his breath, rolling up his eyes to the ceiling. April, June. Right, June's got 30 days. So 12 days from the 18th to the 30th and 10 more makes it the 10th of July.
Oh, dear Lord. She'd read it 3 times. Looking again wouldn't make a difference. Still, she opened the book once more, to the page with John Burgoyne's portrait. A handsome man. And doesn't he just know it, too? She said aloud, making Roger frown at her in consternation, as, painted by Sir Joshua Reynolds, he was in uniform, his hand resting on the hilt of his sword, standing against a dramatic backdrop of gathering storm clouds. And there it was on the next page, plain in black and white. On the 6th of July, General Burgoyne attacked Fort Ticonderoga with a force of some 8,000 regulars, plus several German regiments, under the Baron von Riedesel, and a number of Indians. William found General Burgoyne and his army somewhat more easily than the hunters had discovered General Washington's thereabouts. On the other hand, General Burgoyne was making no attempt to hide. It was a lavish camp by army standards. Neatly arranged rows of white canvas tents covered 3 fields and ran off into the woods. Making his way to the commander's tent to report, he spotted a pile of empty wine bottles near the general's tent that rose nearly to his knee. As he hadn't heard that the general was a notable souse, he assumed this largesse to be the result of an open-handed hospitality and a liking for company. A good sign in a commander, he thought. A yawning servant was picking off the remnants of the lead seals, tossing the metal into a can, presumably to be melted for bullets. He gave William a sleepy, inquiring eye.
I've come to report to General Burgoyne, William said, drawing himself up.
The servant's eye travelled slowly up the length of his body, lingering with vague curiosity on his face, and making him doubt the thoroughness of his morning shave.
"Dinner party with the Brigadier and Colonel St. Ledger last night," the servant said at last, and belched slightly.
"Come back this afternoon. Meanwhile..."
He stood slowly, wincing as though the movement hurt his head, and pointed.
"The mess tent's over there."
Chapter 44. Friends. Fort Ticonderoga, June the 22nd, 1777. Much to my surprise, I found Captain Stebbing sitting up, white-faced, bathed in sweat, and swaying like a pendulum, but upright. Mr. Dick hovered over him, clucking with the tender anxiety of a hen with one chick. "I see you're feeling better, Captain," I said, smiling at him. "Have you on your feet any day now, won't we?"
"Been on my feet," he wheezed. "Think I might die."
"What?"
"Him be walking," Mr. Dick assured me, torn between pride and dismay. "On my arm, but him walk, sure."
I was on my knees listening to lungs and heart through the wooden stethoscope Jamie had made for me. A pulse fit for an 8-cylinder race car, and a good bit of gurgling and wheezing, but nothing horribly alarming. "Congratulations, Captain Stebbings," I said, lowering the stethoscope and smiling at him. He still looked dreadful, but his breathing was beginning to slow. "You probably won't die today. What brought on this burst of ambition?"
"My bosun,"
he managed before a fit of coughing intervened.
"Joe Ormiston," Mr. Dick clarified with a nod in my direction. "Him foot stink. The captain go see him."
"Mr. Ormiston? His foot stinks?" That sounded all sorts of alarm bells. For a wound in this particular setting to smell so notably as to draw attention was a very bad indication. I rose to my feet, but was detained by Stebbings, who had taken a firm grip of my skirt.
"You,"
he said, labouring for air.
"You, take care of him."
He bared stained teeth at me in a grin.
"It's an order,"
he wheezed.
"Mom?"
"Aye, aye, Captain," I said tartly, and made off for the hospital building, where the majority of the sick and wounded were housed.
"Mrs. Fraser, what's amiss?"
The eager cry came from Mrs. Raven, who was coming out of the commissary as I passed. She was tall and lean, with dark hair that perpetually straggled out from under her cap, which it was doing at the moment.
"I don't know yet," I said briefly, not stopping, "but it might be serious." "Oh," she said, barely refraining from adding, "goody."
Tucking her basket under her arm, she fell in beside me, firmly set to do good. Invalid British prisoners were housed alongside the American sick in a long stone building lit by narrow, glassless windows and either freezing or stifling, depending on the weather. It was presently hot and humid outdoors. It was mid-afternoon. And entering the building was like being struck in the face with a hot, wet towel. A dirty, hot, wet towel. It wasn't hard to find Mr. Ormiston. There was a knot of men standing round his cot. Lieutenant Stacto was among them. That was bad. Arguing with little Dr. Hunter. That was good. With a couple of other surgeons trying to put in their own opinions. I knew without looking what they were arguing about. Clearly, Mr. Ormiston's foot had taken a turn for the worse, and they intended to amputate it. In all probability, they were right. The argument would likely be about where to amputate, or who was to do it. Mrs. Raven hung back, nervous at sight of the surgeons.
"Do you really think?"
she began, but I paid her no attention. There are times for thinking, but this wasn't one of them. Only action, and fast, decisive action at that, would serve. I took in a lungful of the thick air and stepped forward. "Good afternoon, Dr. Hunter," I said, elbowing my way between the two militia surgeons and smiling at the young Quaker doctor. "Lieutenant Statko," I added, as an afterthought, not to be overtly rude. I knelt beside the patient's cot, wiped my sweaty hand on my skirt, and took his.
"How are you, Mr. Ormiston? Captain Stebbings has sent me to take care of your foot."
"He what?" Lieutenant Stacto began in a peeved sort of voice. "Really, Mrs. Fraser, what can you possibly—"
"That's good, ma'am," Mr. Ormiston interrupted. "The captain said as how he'd send you. I was just a-telling these gentlemen here as they needn't be concerned, as I was sure you'd know the best way to do it."
And I'm sure they were pleased to hear that, I thought, but smiled at him and squeezed his hand. His pulse was fast and a little light, but regular. His hand, though, was very hot, and I wasn't even faintly surprised to see the reddish streaks of septicemia rising up his leg from the mangled foot. They had unwrapped the foot, and Mr. Dick had unquestionably been right. Him stank.
"Oh, my God!" said Mrs. Raven behind me, in complete sincerity.
Gangrene had set in. If the smell and tissue crepitation were not enough, the toes had begun to blacken already. I didn't waste time in being angry at Stacto. Given the original condition of the foot and the treatment available, I might not have been able to save it either. And the fact that gangrene was so clearly present was actually a help. There couldn't be any question that amputation was necessary. But in that case, I wondered, why were they arguing?
"I take it you agree that amputation is necessary, Mrs. Fraser," the lieutenant said with sarcastic courtesy. "As the patient's physician?"
He had his instruments already laid out on cloth, I saw. Decently kept, not disgustingly filthy, but plainly not sterilized.
"Certainly," I said mildly.
"I am very sorry about it, Mr. Ormiston, but he's right, and you will feel much better with it off. Mrs. Raven, will you go and bring me a pan of boiling water?" I turned to Denzel Hunter, who I saw was holding Mr. Ormiston's other hand, plainly counting his pulse.
"Do you not agree, Dr. Hunter?"
"I do, yes," he said mildly. "We are in disagreement regarding the degree of amputation required, not its necessity.
What is the boiling water for, friend Fraser?" he said.
"Claire," I said briefly. "Sterilization of the instruments, to prevent post-operative infection."
"As much as possible," I added honestly.
Stacto made a very disrespectful noise at this, but I ignored it.
"What do you recommend, Dr. Hunter?"
"Denzel," he said with a fleeting smile. "Friend Stacto wishes to amputate below the knee."
"Of course I do," Stacto said, furious. "I wish to preserve the knee joint, and there is no need to do it higher."
"Oddly enough, I'm inclined to agree with you," I told him, "but turn back to Denzel Hunter."
"But you don't."
He shook his head and pushed his spectacles up the bridge of his nose.
"We must do a mid-femoral amputation. The man has a popliteal aneurysm. That means..."
"I know what it means," I did, and was already feeling behind Mr. Ormiston's knee. He emitted a high-pitched giggle, stopped abruptly, and went red in the face with embarrassment. I smiled at him. "Sorry, Mr. Ormiston," I said. "I won't tickle you again."
"I wouldn't need to."
I could feel the aneurysm plainly. It throbbed gently against my fingers, a big, hard swelling right in the hollow of the joint. He must have had it for some time. A wonder it hadn't burst during the sea battle or the arduous portage to Ticonderoga. In a modern operating room, it might be possible to do the lesser amputation and repair the aneurysm, but not here.
"You're right, friend Denzel," I said, straightening up. "As soon as Mrs. Raven brings the hot water, we'll..."
But the men weren't listening to me. They were staring at something behind me, and I turned to see Guinea Dick stripped to a breech clout because of the heat and glistening with sweat, all his tattoos on display, advancing upon us with a black glass bottle held ceremoniously between his hands.
"Him captain send you grog, Joe," he said to Mr. Ormiston. "Well, God bless the captain for a good un," Mr. Ormiston said in heartfelt thanks.
He took the bottle of rum, drew the cork with his teeth, and began to swallow with a single-minded determination. Sloshing and splashing heralded Mrs. Raven's return with the water. Nearly every fire had a kettle on. Finding boiling water was no difficulty. She had, bless her, also brought a bucket of cold water so that I could wash my hands without burning myself. I took one of the short-bladed, brutal amputation knives, preparing to plunge it into the hot water, only to have it snatched from my hand by an outraged Lieutenant Stacto.
"What are you doing, madam?" he exclaimed. "That is my best blade."
"Yes, that's why I propose to use it," I said, "after I wash it." Statko was a small man with close-cropped bristly grey hair. He was also 2 or 3 inches shorter than I, as I discovered when I stood up and faced him eyeball to eyeball. His face went a shade or two redder.
"You will ruin the temper of the metal, subjecting it to boiling water."
"No," I said, keeping my own temper for the moment. "Hot water will do nothing but clean it, and I will not use a dirty blade on this man."
"Oh, won't you?"
Something like satisfaction glimmered in his eyes, and he clutched the blade protectively to his bosom.
"Well, then, I suppose you'll have to leave the work to those who can do it, won't you?"
Guinea Dick, who had remained to watch after delivery of the bottle, had been following the progress of the argument with interest, and at this point leaned over and plucked the knife from Stacto's hand.
"Him captain says her does for Joe," he said calmly. "Her does."
Stacto's mouth fell open in outrage at this gross insult to his rank, and he lunged at Dick, grabbing for the blade. Dick, with reflexes honed by tribal warfare and years of British seamanship, swung the blade at Stacto with the obvious intent of removing his head. He would likely have succeeded, save for Denzel Hunter's equally good reflexes, which sent him leaping for Dick's arm. He missed, but succeeded in knocking the big guinea man into Stacto. They clutched each other, Dick dropping the knife, and staggered to and fro for an instant before both overbalanced and crashed into Ormiston's cot, sending patient, rum bottle, hot water, Denzel Hunter, and the rest of the instruments sprawling across the stone floor with a clatter that stopped every conversation in the building.
"Ooh,"
said Mrs. Raven, deliciously shocked. This was turning out even better than she had expected.
"Denny," said an equally shocked voice behind me, "what does thee think thee is doing?"
"I am assisting friend Claire in her surgery," Denzel said with some dignity, sitting up and patting round the floor in search of his spectacles.
Rachel Hunter bent and picked up the errant spectacles which had slid across the stones, and restored these firmly to her brother's face, while keeping a wary eye on Lieutenant Stacto, who was slowly rising from the floor, much in the manner of a hot air balloon, visibly swelling with rage.
"You,"
he said in a hoarse voice, and pointed a small trembling finger at Dick.
"I shall have you hanged for assaulting an officer. I shall have you, sir,"
swinging the accusatory digit toward Denzel Hunter, "court-martialed and broke.
As for you, madam."
He spat the word, but then stopped dead, momentarily unable to think of anything sufficiently terrible with which to threaten me. Then,
"I shall ask your husband to beat you," he said.
"Come and tickle me, darling," a slurred voice said from the floor.
I looked down to see a leering Mr. Ormiston. He had kept hold of the rum bottle during the wreck, continued to employ it afterward, and face, suffused with rum, was now making random pawing motions in the vicinity of my knee. Lieutenant Stacto made a noise indicating that this was the frozen limit, if not well beyond, and, hastily bundling up his fallen instruments, he marched off, bristling with knives and saws, dropping occasional small objects in his wake.
"Did thee want me, sissy?"
Denzel Hunter had got to his feet by this time, and was righting the fallen cot.
"Not so much me as Mrs. Brown," his sister said, a dry note in her voice. "She says it is her time, and she wants thee right now."
He snorted briefly and glanced at me.
"Mrs. Brown is an hysteric, in the literal meaning of the term," he said apologetically. "I think she cannot deliver for another month yet, but she suffers false labour on a regular basis."
"I know her," I said, suppressing a smile. "Better you than me, mate." Mrs. Brown was an hysteric, also the wife of a colonel of militia, and therefore, she thought, well above the services of a mere midwife. Hearing that Dr. Denzel Hunter had worked with Dr. John Hunter, who was accoucheur to the Queen, obviously my services could be dispensed with.
She is not bleeding, nor her water broke,
Denzil was asking his sister in a resigned voice.
Guinea Dick, totally unperturbed by the recent conflict, had restored the bedding to the cot, and now squatted, lifted all 15 stone of Mr. Ormiston as if he were a feather bed, and deposited him and his bottle gently thereon.
"I think him ready," he announced, after scrutinising the patient, who was now lying back, eyes closed, happily murmuring, "Just a little lower, dear. Aye, that's it. That's it."
Denzil looked helplessly from Mr. Ormiston to his sister, to me.
"I will have to go to Mrs. Brown, though I think it not pressingly urgent. Can thee wait a little while, and I will do this for thee?"
"Her does it," said Dick, glowering.
"Yes, her does," I assured him, tying back my hair. "But what her is going to do it with is another question. Have you any instruments that I might borrow, Doctor, friend Denzil?" He rubbed his forehead, thinking.
"I have a decent saw,"
he smiled briefly,
"and I do not mind if thee wishes to boil it, but no heavy blade. Shall I send Rachel to ask one of the other surgeons?"
Rachel's face closed a bit at this suggestion, and I thought that perhaps Dr. Hunter was not all that popular with the other surgeons. I eyed Mr. Ormiston's very solid leg, estimating the thickness of flesh to be cut, and put a hand through the slit in my skirt to the sheath of my knife. It was a good, sturdy knife, and Jamie had just sharpened it for me. A curved blade would be better, but I thought the length was sufficient. "No, don't trouble. I think this will work. If you would find your brother's saw, Miss, Rachel," I smiled at her, "and Mrs. Raven, I'm afraid the water's gone. Would you—"
"Oh, yes,"
she cried, and seizing the pan, clattered off, kicking one of Lieutenant Stacktoe's oddments on the way. A number of people had been watching the drama of Mr. Ormiston's foot, fascinated. Now that the lieutenant was gone, they began to sidle nearer, looking fearfully at Guinea Dick, who grinned genially at them.
"Can Mrs. Brown wait a quarter of an hour?" I asked Denzil. "It will be a little easier if I have someone who knows what they're doing to support the leg while I cut. Dick can restrain the patient." "A quarter of an hour?"
"Well, the actual amputation will take a little less than a minute if I don't encounter any difficulties. But I'll need a bit of time to prepare, and I could use your help in ligating the severed blood vessels afterward. Where has the rum bottle gone, by the way?"
Denzel's dark eyebrows were almost touching his hairline, but he gestured to Mr. Ormiston, who had gone to sleep and was now snoring loudly, the rum bottle cradled in his arm.
"I don't propose to drink it," I said dryly, answering his expression. I pulled the bottle free and poured a little onto a clean rag with which I began to swab Mr. Ormiston's hairy thigh. The lieutenant had fortunately left his jar of sutures, and the oddment Mrs. Raven had kicked was a tenaculum. I would need it to seize the ends of severed arteries, which had an annoying tendency to pop back into the flesh and hide, squirting blood all the while.
"Ah," said Denzil, still at a loss but game. "I see. Can I help?
If I might borrow your belt for a ligature?"
"Oh, yes,"
he murmured, and unbuckled it without hesitation, looking interested.
"I collect thee has done this before."
"Many times, unfortunately." I bent to check Mr. Ormiston's breathing, which was stertorous but not laboured. He'd downed nearly half the bottle within 5 minutes. That was a dose that would likely kill someone less inured to rum than a British seaman. But his vital signs were reasonably good, fever notwithstanding. Drunkenness was not by any means the equivalent of anaesthesia. The patient was stunned, not unconscious, and would certainly come to when I began cutting. It did allay fear, though, and might dull the immediate pain slightly. I wondered whether, and when, I might ever be able to make ether again.
There were two or three small tables in the long room, these heaped with bandages, lint, and other dressing materials. I chose a good supply of relatively clean materials and returned with them to the bedside, just as Mrs. Raven, panting and red-faced, anxious lest she had missed anything, arrived. Pan of water sloshing. A moment later, Rachel Hunter returned, similarly panting from her hurry, with her brother's saw. "If you would not mind dousing the saw blade, friend Denzel," I said, tying a burlap sack round my waist to serve as an apron. Sweat was running down my back, tickling between my buttocks, and I tied a length of bandaging around my head, bandana style, to keep the sweat from running into my eyes as I worked. "And scrub the stains there, near the handle? Then my knife and that tenaculum, if you don't mind." Looking bemused, he did, to interested murmurs from the crowd, who had plainly never witnessed such an outlandish proceeding, though Mr. Dick's savage presence was keeping them at a safe distance.
"Does thee suppose the lieutenant would indeed have our friend here hanged?" Denzel whispered to me with a nod at Dick. "Or could, come to that?
I'm sure he'd love to, but I really don't think he can, no. Mr. Dick is an English prisoner. Can he have you court-martialed, do you think?"
"I suppose he might try," Denzel said,
seeming not perturbed at the prospect.
"I enlisted, after all."
"Did you?" That seemed odd, but he wasn't the only Quaker I'd met on a battlefield, so to speak.
"Oh, yes. I think the army does not have so many surgeons that it can afford to hang one, though. And I doubt that being reduced in rank would much affect my expertise."
He smiled cheerfully at me.
"Thee has no rank at all, if I'm not mistaken. And yet, I trust thee will manage."
"God willing," I said. And he nodded gravely.
"God willing," he repeated.
And handed me the knife, still hot from the boiling water. "You might want to stand back a bit," I said to the spectators. "It's going to be messy." "Oh dear, oh dear," said Mrs. Raven with a tremulous gasp of anticipation. "How perfectly ghastly." Chapter 45. Three Arrows. June 10th, 1777. Motteville, Pennsylvania. Gray sat up suddenly, narrowly avoiding cracking his head on the low beam that passed above his bed. His heart was pounding, his neck and temples wet with sweat, and he had no notion for a moment where he was.
"The third arrow," he said aloud,
and shook his head, trying to match the words to the extraordinarily vivid dream from which he had so abruptly emerged. Was it dream, memory, or something partaking of the nature of both? He had been standing in the main salon of Trois Flèches, looking at the very fine stubs hanging to the right of the Baroque mantelpiece. The walls were crowded with pictures, hung above, below, crammed in without regard to subject or merit. Was that how it had been? He remembered vaguely a sense of oppression at the abundance of ornament, but had the paintings truly crowded in so? Portraits leering from above, below, faces in every direction? In the dream, the Baron Amandine had stood to one side of him, the solid shoulder touching his. They were much of a height. The Baron was speaking of one of the paintings, but Gray couldn't remember what he was saying. Something about the technique employed by the painter, perhaps. On his other side stood Cécile Bouchon, the Baron's sister, standing equally close, her bare shoulder brushing Gray's. She wore powder in her hair and a perfume of jasmine. The Baron, a feral cologne of bergamot and civet. He remembered, for surely dreams had no smell, the mingling of the thick fragrances with the bitterness of wood ash in the stifling warmth of the room, and the faint feeling of nausea this mingling induced. Someone's hand had cupped one of his buttocks, squeezing it familiarly, and then commenced to stroke it in an insinuating fashion. He didn't know whose hand it was. That hadn't been part of the dream. He lay back slowly on his pillow, eyes closed, trying to recapture the images from his sleeping mind. The dream had changed after that to something erotic, someone's mouth on his highly responsive flesh. It was the sensations associated with this, in fact, that wakened him. He didn't know whose mouth it was either. Dr. Franklin had been somewhere in this dream as well. Gray recalled the white buttocks, slightly sagging, still firm, as the man walked down a corridor in front of him, long grey hair straggling down a bony back, loose rolls of skin around the waist, talking with complete unconcern about the pictures which lined the walls of the corridor as well. It was a vivid recollection, charged with feeling.
Surely he hadn't. Not with Franklin, even in a dream. But it was something to do with the paintings.
He tried to recall some of the paintings, but was no longer sure what was real, what emerged from the bourne of dreams. There were landscapes, a thing purporting to be an Egyptian scene, though he took leave to doubt that the painter had ever set foot south of the Breton coast. The usual family portraits?
Yes.
He sat up abruptly and this time did smack the crown of his head on the beam, hard enough that he saw stars, and emitted a grunt of pain.
Uncle John?
Dotty's voice came clearly from the other bed, startled, and a rustling of bedclothes from the floor indicated that her maid had likewise wakened.
What's happened?
Nothing, nothing. Go back to sleep.
He swung his legs out of bed.
Just going to the privy.
Oh.
Flouncings and mutterings from the floor. A sternly rebuking shush from Dotty. He found the chamber door by feel, for the shutters had been put up, and the room was black as sin, and made his way downstairs by the dim light from the banked fire in the inn's main room. The air outside was fresh and cool, scented with something he didn't recognise but that tugged at his memory. It was a relief to let go the struggle with his obstinate dream and submerge himself in this purely sensory remembrance. It brought back long rides in Virginia, muddy roads, fresh leaves, the sense of a horse beneath him, the kick of a gun, the feel of a deer's blood spilling hot over his hand. Of course, hunting with William. He felt the immediacy of the wilderness wash over him, that strong, strange sense so peculiar to America, the sense of something waiting among the trees, not inimical, but not welcoming either. He had loved those few years in Virginia, away from the intrigues of Europe, the constant sociality of London. Valued them mostly, though, for the closeness that had grown between him and his son in those years in the wilderness. He had not yet seen fireflies on this journey. He glanced into the thick grass as he walked, but it was probably too late. Fireflies came out mostly in the early evening. He looked forward to showing them to Dotty. William had been enchanted by his first sight of them when they came to live in Virginia, had caught them in his hand, cupping one gently and exclaiming as it lit the darkened hollow of his palm, had greeted their return each summer with joy. Relieved in body, and at least superficially soothed in mind, he sat slowly down on the chopping block in the inn yard, unwilling to return yet to the frowsy darkness above. Where was Henry? He wondered. Where did he sleep tonight? Housed in some dungeon? No, the colonies really had no such thing. Even common houses were remarkably comfortable and airy. Perhaps his nephew was held in a jail, a barn, some cellar. And yet he had, so far as they knew, survived the winter in spite of what must be a serious wound. He would have had money, though. Perhaps he'd been able to pay for better housing, perhaps a doctor's care. God willing they would find him soon. They were no more than 2 days' ride from Philadelphia, and he had the letters of introduction that Franklin had given him. Franklin again, damn the man and his air bathing. Though Gray had joined him in this process once, from curiosity, and found it oddly pleasant, if a little unnerving, to be sitting mother naked in a room equipped with elegant furniture, potted palms in the corners, paintings on the... No. No. There were no paintings in the solar at Trois Flèches, of course not. There it was, the tail of his elusive dream twitching tantalizingly at him from under a rock. He closed his eyes, filled his lungs with the scent of the summer night, and purposely forced his mind to go blank. Trois flèches. Three arrows. Who is the third? The words of Hal's letter appeared on the inside of his eyelid, sufficiently startling that he opened his eyes. Used as he was to Hal's oblique thought processes, he hadn't made much of this at the time. Evidently, it had taken root in his subconscious, though, only to emerge in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, out of the depths of an absurd dream. Why? He rubbed gently at the crown of his head, which was sore from his collision with the beam, but not broken. His fingers unconsciously moved down, fingering the spot where Jamie Fraser's wife had covered the trepan hole in his skull with a silver sixpence, hammered flat. She had stitched the skin over it quite cleverly, and the hair had grown again, but it was easy to feel the small, hard curve under it. He seldom noticed or thought of it, save in cold weather, when the metal grew markedly cold and sometimes caused headache and made his nose run. It had been cold, very cold, when he visited Trois Flèches. The thought floated through his head like a moth. There were sounds behind the inn, the clop of hooves on packed dirt, the murmur of voices. He sat very still. The moon was halfway down. It was late, but hours yet till dawn. No one should have business at this hour, save it was a dark business. The sort of business he had no desire to witness, let alone to be seen witnessing. They were coming, though. He couldn't move without being seen, and instead stilled even his breathing to the barest wisp of air. Three men, quiet, purposeful, on horseback, one leading a laden mule. They passed no more than 2 paces from him, but he didn't move, and the horses, if they sensed him, found him no threat. They turned onto the road that led to Philadelphia. Why this secrecy, he wondered, but didn't waste time in much wondering. He had noticed it at once upon his return to North Carolina the year before, a morbid excitement, an uneasiness in the air itself. It was more pronounced here. He had been aware of it since they had landed. People were wary in a way that they hadn't been. They don't know who to trust, he thought. And so they trust no one. The thought of trust conjured an immediate and vivid recollection of Percy Wainwright. If there is anyone in the world I trust less. And just like that, he had it. The picture of Percy, dark-eyed and smiling, thumb running over the surface of his wine glass as though he stroked Grey's prick, saying casually, I married one of the sisters of the Baron Ormandine. One of the sisters, Grey whispered aloud, and the dream crystallized in his mind, the sense of cold from the stones of Trois Flèches so vivid that he shivered, though the night wasn't cold at all. Felt the warmth of those two lascivious, vicious bodies pressing on him from either side. And on the wall, to one side, disregarded among the careless profusion, a small painting of 3 children, 2 girls, 1 boy, posed with a dog, and the outer wall of Trois Flèches recognizable behind them. The second sister. The third arrow, whom Hal, with his unerring sense of oddity, had never seen, but had noticed nonetheless. The Beauchamps were a noble, ancient family, and like most such families, they referred often, if casually, to themselves. He had heard during his visit of the doings of cousins, uncles, aunts, distant connections, but never of the second sister. She might have died in childhood, of course, such things were common. But in that case, why would Percy have said? Now his head was beginning to ache. With a sigh, he rose and went inside. He had no notion where or when, but he was going to have to speak to Percy again. He was appalled to find that the prospect did not alarm him. Chapter 46. Ley Lines. Brianna paused by the fish-viewing chamber. It wasn't yet the breeding season when, she'd been told, the great salmon swarmed through the chutes of the fish ladder that allowed them to climb the dam at Pitlochry. But now and then, a silvery flash shot into view with heart-stopping suddenness, fighting strongly against the current for a moment before shooting up into the tube that led to the next stage of the ladder. The chamber itself was a small white housing let into the side of the fish ladder, with an algae-clouded window. She'd paused there to gather her thoughts, or rather, to suppress some of them, before going into the dam. It was nonsense to worry about something that had already happened, and she did know that her parents were all right. Or at least, she amended, had made it out of Fort Ticonderoga. There were a good many letters left. And she could at any moment read those letters too and find out. That was what made it so ridiculous. She supposed she wasn't really worried, just preoccupied. The letters were wonderful, but at the same time she was only too aware of how much even the most complete letter must leave out. And according to Roger's book, General Burgoyne had left Canada in early June, his plan being to march south and join General Howe's troops, cutting the colonies essentially in half. And on July 6th, 1777, he had paused to attack Fort Ticonderoga. What?
Koyasin, said a voice behind her.
She jerked round, startled, to find Rob Cameron standing there, gesturing excitedly at the fish-viewing window. She turned back just in time to see a tremendous silver fish, spotted dark over the back, give a great heave against the current before disappearing up the chute.
Nachasin anrud aspriaga ahu nag hu riav,
he said, the wonder of it still showing on his face.
Is that not the most beautiful thing you've ever seen?
Hawur, she replied, wary, but unable not to smile in return.
Almost.
His own smile remained, but became more personal as he focused on her.
Ah, you do have the Gaelic. My cousin said, but I didn't quite believe it. You with your proper Boston accent, he said, drawing the syllables in what he plainly thought was a proper Boston accent.
Yeah, park your car in Harvard Yard, she said, in a real but exaggerated one. He burst out laughing.
How'd you do that? You don't speak Gaelic with that sort of accent. I mean, you've got one, but it's different. More like you'd hear on the Isles. Barra, maybe, or Uist.
My da was Scots, she said. I got it from him. That made him look at her afresh, as though she were a novel sort of fish he'd just pulled up on his hook.
Yeah? From round here? What's his name?
James Fraser, she replied.
Safe enough. There were dozens.
And was. He's gone.
Ah, too bad, he said sympathetically,
and briefly touched her arm.
Lost my dad last year. Tough, eh?
Yes, she said briefly, and made to go past him. He turned at once and fell into step beside her.
You got wee ones too, Roger said.
He felt her start of surprise and smiled sideways at her.
Met him in lodge. Nice guy.
Yes, he is, she said, guarded. Roger hadn't mentioned meeting Rob, and she did wonder why not. Clearly he'd talked with Rob long enough for Rob to know that Roger was her husband and that they had children. Rob didn't pursue the reference any further, though, instead stretching and throwing back his head.
Ah, too nice a day to spend in a dam. Wish I could be on the water.
He nodded toward the tumbling river, where half a dozen bewadered anglers stood among the waves with the predatory intentness of herons.
You or Roger fly fish at all?
I have, she said, and felt the memory of a casting rod whipping in her hands, sending a small thrill up the nerve endings.
You fish then? Aye. I've got a permission for Rothy Marcus.
He looked proud, as though this was something special, so she made approving noises. He glanced sideways at her, caramel-eyed and smiling.
"If you ever want to come out with your rod, just say the word, boss."
He grinned suddenly at her, careless and charming, and went ahead of her into the damn office, whistling.
A ley line is an observed alignment between two geographical features of interest, usually an ancient monument or megalith. There are a number of theories about ley lines, and considerable controversy as to whether they actually exist as a phenomenon, and not only as an artifact. By that I mean that if you choose any two points that are of interest for humans, there's very likely to be a path that leads between them, no matter what those points are. There's a major roadway between London and Edinburgh, for instance, because people frequently want to go from one to the other, but this is not normally called a ley line. What people usually have in mind when using this term is an ancient pathway that leads, say, from a standing stone to an ancient abbey, which is itself likely built on a spot of much older worship. Since there isn't much objective evidence beyond the obvious existence of such lines, there's a lot of guff talked about them. Some people think the lines have a magical or mystical significance. I don't see any grounds for this myself, and neither does your mother, who is a scientist. On the other hand, science changes its mind now and then, and what looks like magic may really have a scientific explanation. NB put in footnote about Claire and the plant harvesting. However, among the theories regarding ley lines, there is one that appears to have at least a possible physical basis. Perhaps you will already know what dowsers are by the time you come to read this. I will take you out with one as soon as the opportunity occurs. Just in case, though, a dowser is a person who can detect the presence of water, or sometimes bodies of metal underground, like the ore in mines. Some of them use a Y-forked stick, a metal rod, or some other object with which to divine the water. Some merely sense it. The actual basis of this skill is not known. Your mother says that Occam's razor would say that such people just recognise the type of geology that is most likely to harbour underground water. I've seen dowsers work, though, and I'm pretty sure that there is more to it than that, especially in view of the theories I'm telling you here. One theory of how dowsing works is that the water, or metal, has a magnetic current to which the dowser is sensitive. Your mother says that the first part of this is true, and that furthermore, there are large bands of geomagnetic force in the Earth's crust which run in opposing directions all round the globe. Further, she tells me that these bands are detectable by objective measures, but are not necessarily permanent. Indeed, the Earth undergoes occasionally, every umpty million years, I think, she didn't know the exact frequency, reversals of its geomagnetic force. Nobody knows why, but the usual suspect is sunspots, with the poles exchanging places. Another interesting bit of information is that homing pigeons, and quite possibly other sorts of birds, demonstrably do sense these geomagnetic lines and use them to navigate by, though no one yet has figured out quite how they do it. What we suspect, your mother and I must emphasise that we may easily be wrong in this supposition, is that ley lines do exist, that they are, or correlate with, lines of geomagnetic force, and that where they cross or converge, you get a spot where this magnetic force is different, for lack of a better word. We think these convergences, or some of them, may be the places where it is possible for people who are sensitive to such forces, like pigeons, I suppose, to go from one time to another. That would be your mother and me, and you, Jem and Mandy. If the person reading this is a child, or grandchildren not yet born, then I don't know whether you will have this sensitivity, ability, what you may call it, but I assure you that it is real. Your grandmother speculated that it is a genetic trait, much like the ability to roll one's tongue. If you haven't got it, the how of it is simply incomprehensible,
even though you can observe it in someone who does have the trait. If that's the case for you, I don't know whether to apologize or congratulate you, though I suppose it's no worse than the other things parents give their children, all unknowing, like crooked teeth or short-sightedness. We didn't do it on purpose either way. Please believe that. Sorry, I've got off the track here. The basic point is that the ability to time travel may be dependent on a genetic sensitivity to these convergences, vortices, of ley lines. Owing to the peculiar geological history of the British Isles, you find a lot of ley lines here, and likewise, a great number of archaeological sites that seem to be linked by those lines. Your mother and I intend to note, so far as can be done without danger, and make no mistake about this, it is very dangerous, the occurrence of such sites as might be portals. Obviously, there is no way of knowing for sure whether a specific site is a portal or not. The observation that sites seem to be open on the dates that correspond to the sun feasts and fire feasts of the ancient world, or at least more open than at other times, may, if this hypothesis is right, have something to do with the gravitational pull of the sun and moon. This seems reasonable. Given that those bodies really do affect the behaviour of the Earth with respect to tides, weather and the like, why not time vortices too, after all? Footnote. Your mother says, well, she said quite a bit, in which I picked out the words unified field theory, which I gather is something that doesn't yet exist. But if it did, it would explain a hell of a lot of things. And among these might be an answer to why a convergence of geomagnetic lines might affect time in the spot where the convergence occurs. All I personally got from this explanation is the notion that space and time are occasionally the same thing, and gravity is somehow involved. This makes as much sense to me as anything else regarding this phenomenon. Footnote 2. Does that make sense? Roger asked. So far, at least. Insofar as anything about it makes sense, yes. Despite the uneasiness that came over her whenever they discussed it, she couldn't help smiling at him. He looked so earnest. There was a blotch of ink on his cheek, and his black hair was ruffled up on one side. Professoring must be in the blood, she said, pulling a tissue out of her pocket, licking it in mother cat fashion, and applying it to his face. You know, there's this wonderful modern invention called a ballpoint.
Hate them,
he said, closing his eyes and suffering himself to be tidied.
Besides, a fountain pen is a great luxury compared to a quill.
Well, that's true. Da always looked like an explosion in an ink factory when he'd been writing letters. Her eyes returned to the page, and she snorted briefly at the first footnote, making Roger smile.
Is that a decent explanation?
Considering that this is meant for the kids, more than adequate, she assured him, lowering the page. What goes in footnote 2?
Ah.
He leaned back in his chair, hands linked, looking uneasy.
That.
Yes, that, she said, instantly alerted. Is there something like an Exhibit A that's meant to go there?
Well, yes,
he said reluctantly, and met her eyes.
Gillis Duncan's notebooks. Mrs. Graham's book would be Exhibit B. Your mother's explanation of planting superstitions is footnote 4.
Brianna could feel the blood draining from her head and sat down just in case. You're sure that's a good idea? She asked, tentative. She didn't herself know where Gillis Duncan's notebooks were, and didn't want to. The little book that Fiona Graham, Mrs. Graham's granddaughter, had given them was safely tucked away in a safe deposit box in the Royal Bank of Scotland in Edinburgh. Roger blew out his breath and shook his head.
No, I'm not, he said frankly. But look, we don't know how old the kids will be when they read this. Which reminds me, We need to make some kind of provision about it, just in case something happens to us before they're old enough to be told everything.
She felt as though a melting ice cube was sliding slowly down her back. He was right, though. They might both be killed in a car crash, like her mother's parents. Or the house might burn.
Well, no, she said aloud, looking at the window behind Roger, which was set into a stone wall some 18 inches thick. I don't suppose this house will burn down.
That made him smile.
No, not too worried about that. But the notebooks, I know what you mean. I did think of maybe just going through them myself and sort of straining out the information. She did have quite a bit about which stone circles seem to be active, and that's useful, because reading the rest of it is...
He waved a hand in search of the right word.
Creepy, she supplied.
I was going to say, like watching someone go slowly mad in front of you, but creepy will do.
He took the pages from her and tapped them together.
It's just an academic tic, I suppose. I don't feel right in suppressing an original source.
She gave a different snort, one indicating what she thought of Gillis Duncan as an original source of anything bar trouble.
Still, I suppose you're right, she said reluctantly. Maybe you could do a summary, though, and just mention where the notebooks are, in case someone down the line is really curious.
Not a bad thought.
He put the papers inside the notebook and rose, closing it as he did so.
I'll go down and get them then, maybe when school's out. I could take Jem and show him the city. He's old enough to walk the Royal Mile, and he'd love the castle.
Do not take him to the Edinburgh dungeon, she said at once, and he broke into a broad grin.
What? You don't think wax figures of people being tortured are educational? That's all historical, eh?
It would be a lot less horrible if it wasn't, she said, and turning, caught sight of the wall clock. Roger, aren't you supposed to be doing your Gaelic class at the school at 2 o'clock? He glanced at the clock in disbelief, snatched up the pile of books and papers on his desk, and shot out of the room in a flurry of very eloquent Gaelic. She went out into the hall to see him hastily kiss Mandy and charge for the door. Mandy stood in the open doorway, waving enthusiastically.
Bye-bye, Daddy, she cried. Bring me ice cream.
If he forgets, we'll go into the village after supper and get some, Brianna promised, bending down to pick her daughter up. She stood there, holding Mandy, watching Roger's ancient orange Morris cough, choke, shudder, and start up with a brief belch of blue smoke. She frowned slightly at the sight, thinking she must get him a set of new spark plugs, but waved as he leaned out at the corner of the drive, smiling back at them. Mandy snuggled close, murmuring one of Roger's more picturesque Gaelic phrases, which she was obviously committing to memory, and Bree bent her head, inhaling the sweet scent of Johnson's baby shampoo and grubby child. No doubt it was the mention of Gillis Duncan that was making her feel still uneasy. The woman was well and truly dead. But after all, she was Roger's multiple great-grandmother. And perhaps the ability to travel through stone circles was not the only thing to be passed down through the blood. Though surely some things were diluted by time. Roger, for instance, had nothing in common with William Buckley Mackenzie, Gillis's son by Dougal Mackenzie, and the man responsible for Roger's being hanged.
Son of a witch, she said under her breath. I hope you rot in hell.
That's a bad word, Mummy, Mandy said reprovingly.
It went better than he could have hoped. The schoolroom was crowded, with lots of kids, a number of parents, and even a few grandparents crammed in round the walls. He had that moment of lightheadedness, not quite panic or stage fright, but a sense of looking into some vast canyon that he couldn't see the bottom of, that he was used to from his days as a performer. He took a deep breath, put down his stack of books and papers, smiled at them, and said,
"Face gamma."
That's all it ever took. The first word spoken or sung, and it was like taking hold of a live wire. A current sprang up between him and the audience, and the next word seemed to come from nowhere, flowing through him like the crash of water through one of Bree's giant turbines. After a word or two of introduction, he started with the notion of Gallic cursing, knowing why most of the kids had come. A few parents' brows shot up, but small, knowing smiles appeared on the faces of the grandparents.
"We haven't got bad words in the Gallic, like there are in the English," he said,
and grinned at the feisty-looking towhead in the second row who had to be the wee glass-cock bugger who told Jimmy he was going to hell.
"Sorry, Jimmy." "Which is not to say you can't give a good, strong opinion of someone," he went on, as soon as the laughter subsided.
"But Gallic cursing is a matter of art,
not crudeness."
That got a ripple of laughter from the old people too, and several of the kids' heads turned toward their grandparents, amazed.
"For example, I once heard a farmer whose pig got into the mash tell her that he hoped her intestines would burst through her belly and be eaten by crows."
An impressed "ooh" from the kids, and he smiled and went on, giving carefully edited versions of some of the more creative things he'd heard his father-in-law say on occasion. No need to add that, lack of bad words notwithstanding, it is indeed possible to call someone a daughter of a bitch when wishing to be seriously nasty. If the kids wanted to know what Jem had really said to Miss Glendinning, they'd have to ask him, if they hadn't already. From there, he went on to a more serious but quick description of the Gaeltacht, that area of Scotland where Gaelic was traditionally spoken, and told a few anecdotes of learning the Gaelic on herring boats in the Minch as a teenager, including the entire speech given by a particular Captain Taylor when a storm scoured out his favourite lobster hole and made away with all his pots. This piece of eloquence having been addressed with shaken fist to the sea, the heavens, the crew, and the lobsters. That one had them rolling again, and a couple of the old buggers in the back were grinning and muttering to one another, they having obviously encountered similar situations.
"But the Gaelic is a language," he said,
when the laughter had died down once more,
"and that means its primary use is for communicating, people talking to one another. How many of you have ever heard line singing, walking songs?"
Murmurs of interest. Some had, some hadn't. So he explained what walking was.
"The women all working together, pushing and pulling and kneading the wet wool cloth to make it tight and waterproof, because they didn't have mats or wellies in the old days. And folk would need to be out of doors day and night in all kinds of weather, tending their animals or their crofts."
His voice was well warmed by now. He thought he could make it through a brief walking song, and, flipping open the folder, sang them the first verse and refrain, then got them to do it as well. They got four verses, and then he could feel the strain starting to tell, and brought it to a close. "My gran used to sing that one," one of the mothers blurted impulsively, then blushed red as a beet as everyone looked at her.
"Is your gran still alive?" Roger asked,
and at her abashed nod said,
"Well then, have her teach it to you, and you can teach it to your kids. That kind of thing shouldn't be lost, eh?"
A small murmur of half-surprised agreement, and he smiled again and lifted the battered hymn book he'd brought.
"Right. I mentioned the line singing, too. You'll still hear this of a Sunday in Kirk out on the Isles. Go to Stornoway, for instance, and you'll hear it. It's a way of singing the psalms that goes back to when folk hadn't many books, or perhaps not so many of the congregation could read. So there'd be a precentor, whose job it was to sing the psalm one line at a time, and then the congregation would sing it back to him. This book,"
and he raised